Welcome, everyone. Thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, asking the question, why wait for heaven? On 1-2 Radio, changing the way we experience life and spirituality. Today is October 3rd, 2014, and on today's show, I am happy to welcome back Bruce Rawls, ACIM teacher and workshop facilitator, among many other things. He's involved in multiple ACIM study groups in Colorado and in Oregon, and in addition to his interest in ACIM, Bruce is a metaphysical researcher, an artist, presenter and author of Sacred Geometry Design Sourcebook. Now, today's topic is level confusion. Those of you studying the course know what that is. Those who are not students are probably going, what? And scratching your head. But please listen up. I think you will find this topic a real eye-opener. And while you're listening, please join us in the 12listen.com, or actually that's 12radio.com private group on Facebook. One of the easiest ways to get there is to go to 12radio website, and on the left side of the page, click the chat button. You'll be automatically redirected to our private group. And if you're not already a member, don't worry, because you just hit that join button and come on into the 12radio chat. And that guy at the door ready to let you in, that's Scott Weaver, our producer. So Scott, thank you for being here today. Thank you for keeping everything online and for, you know, monitoring the chat room with me. I really appreciate that. So without further ado, let's welcome Bruce. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you, CA and Scott. Thank you for having me back on your show.
Hey, and as an aside, I don't want this to get us sidetracked, but I had to tell you this. Do you have any particular affinity to mountain lions?
Mountain lions. I've kind of, not that I can think of.
Okay, well.
I mean, nothing specific comes to mind anyway, other than just, you know, a critter out in the wild that, you know, once in a while I mostly hear about. I haven't really seen. I think I did see a wildcat in Northern California, from about three quarters of a mile or a mile away on another adjacent hillside years ago, running very quickly for cover. And when we came up the side of this hill. But other than that, nothing specific. So what was your connection?
Maybe it is my split mind here. But in any case, it was just so funny because I was making some notes for myself about things I wanted to talk about today. And I was writing your name, or at least that's what I thought I was writing. So all of a sudden, I look at it and I wrote mountain lion. And I went, oh, what? And then I scratch it out and I go, no, Bruce. Bruce, that's what I'm trying to say here. But it is funny. I did recently see a mountain lion because I was in the mountains and I was actually in a car and it ran across the road, or rather I should say it leaped across the road in front of me. But it was just so funny that I think I'm thinking of you and your name, and all of a sudden I write mountain lion. So I thought, okay, I just have to ask him because maybe there's some affinity here. You know, maybe mountain lion represents leadership. So maybe when I think of you, I think of leadership, and maybe that's why I did that in my head.
Well, I hope that's helpful. The only thing that comes to mind is I've used a lot of Mac operating systems, and one of them has been named Mountain Lion.
Oh,
and I have, this is probably a subject better for your other show on astrology. I have Pluto and Leo. That's about the only thing that comes to mind that might be a connection. But
well, it's so, like I said, it's so funny that would happen, because all of a sudden where your name should have been, Mountain Lion, was sitting there. Huh. And you know, sometimes you just do weird things like that. But you know, let's hope that it's because I see you as a leader, and so all of a sudden I was juxtaposing your name with Mountain Lion. And you know, talk about level confusion.
Yes.
Maybe that's a good segue into what we're talking about
today. I think it's a great one, because I find that when I put myself in the driver's seat, so to speak, metaphorically or metaphysically, that's when I usually find myself either lost or in some sort of peril of one sort or another. So that kind of reminds me of a favorite course quote of you know, that you still think that your understanding of the truth is a powerful contribution to the truth and makes it what it is.
Yes.
I think that's really an important one, because, I mean, and I think it really fits in well with the subject of level confusion, because we are so far down the ladder, if you will, that in terms of reality, that, and we're so enmired in this whole space-time dream that, you know, we think, and another quote that comes to mind is that, you know, we think that some of our success, our greatest successes are failures and vice, which are really, you know, vice versa kind of thing. Uh-huh. I forget the exact quote, but it was, you know, it's like we don't really have a basis for understanding. We, another place I think in the workbook, it says, you know, we would have to be aware of an inconceivably vast amount of things in order to make, to be really qualified to make any kind of accurate judgment. We have to know the entirety of the past, entirety of the future, entirety of the whole cosmos, you know, of which we just barely know our neighborhood, let alone, you know, our household or neighborhood, let alone the state we live in, the country, the planet, and the solar system. You know, I mean, we're babes here.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. That's actually one of my very favorite, you know, quotes from the course, even though I don't know it by heart. And I'm not sure. I think it's in the manual for teachers when he's talking about judgment. And he says, you know, I'm not telling you that you can't judge. I'm saying literally you can't judge.
Right, you don't
have the information.
Exactly.
You don't have nearly the information that you would need to make a judgment. So I'm not telling you don't. I'm telling you that you're silly to even think that you can. And, you know, when you read that, those are some of the quotes to me that just hit me right between the eyes.
Oh, exactly.
You know, because it's so obvious. Like if you could know every possible outcome, then maybe you can start judging. But until you say that, then you're not qualified. So just let it go.
Yeah. And based in that assumption that we have, you know, some basis for judgment is really predicated on the idea that we actually have some, you know, some grasp of our ability to change what we think of as reality, and even more fundamentally, that changing that reality, quote unquote, with big heavy quotes around the word reality, is somehow going to lead to our happiness. And I think that's the part of the subterfuge, which is one of the words in this Level of Confusion article that was inspiring me that I sent earlier, that Ken Wapnick wrote in the Lighthouse series. That you know, it's really a subterfuge. It's basically a game of hide and seek, of kind of like when you get a magician on stage, and you know, what's a Las Vegas show or something on TV. You know, the whole emphasis really is on distraction.
Yes.
And if as long as your attention can be diverted to where the magician wants you to look. And you know, metaphorically to identify with, then we think, oh, that's the thing that's happening, and we get, you know, the wool gets pulled over our own eyes by ourselves every time, and that's because we're looking at the effect rather than the cause, and I think that's one of the critical ideas in the course that is so important, that mind is really cause, and that's really what the entire book is addressing, that we're a mind that, oh, by the way, you know, seems to be in a body, but that mind actually has really only one choice it can make at any given moment, and that's between what the course calls, which seems to be a religious term, but it's not, is the Holy Spirit, which really is synonymous in terms of the effect, in effect, it's synonymous with the Jesus of the course, which is not to be confused with the Jesus of conventional formal religion. I like the term inner kindness teacher, because I think inner kindness is basically a realization that if we include everyone, as difficult as that it can be sometimes, that the voice for that counsel is really suggesting to us that if we see everyone as the same and everything in this world is the same, which again is a really challenging thing to do, that is incredibly liberating, because that basically returns us to our mind. That idea of, and the way we get to that is through shared interests, by looking at what do I have in common with everyone else. And I think that really is you know, again, part of the confusion where we think that what's really important is the what's in it for me. And that's really sort of the bottom of the ladder that Ken talks about, Ken Wapnick, in his writings and videos and audios and so many other media, that he refers to whenever we think in terms of victimhood, you know, the temptation to see yourself unfairly treated. And if we really look at our minds, it's rampant.
Yes.
and it gets kind of scary, but we don't have to do it all at once. We just have to kind of notice it maybe a little more often, you know, each day. And eventually we'll see that, you know, the ego's paradigm, which is, you know, choice B, is, you know, the shall we say, the choice that we keep trying and never quite making it work for us. That choice is always available. And it's 100% insane. It's 100% brilliant because our minds are brilliant, but we've made up this entire world to keep us, you know, like the magician wants us distracted and focused on the physical outcome, the particulars, the specifics of the situations that we find ourselves in, and thinking that we're the victim. You know, to quote a lyric from the Bosom Buddies show, the Billy Joel song, I never said I was a victim of circumstance. Well, we don't say it, but we think it and we feel it over and over again, it moment to moment throughout our lives. Even if it's just kind of a feeling of kind of blahness or boredom, there's always, as Ken says, there's always a face. There's always a, if we really look deep enough, there's always, if it's not our parents, it's the environment, the world, it's always something out there that is the cause of our upset or our unhappiness. And if we can bring that inside, I think we can collapse the dream of space by realizing there's nobody out there. There's a physicist named John Wheeler who basically says there's no out there out there.
Right.
And so if modern physics can suggest that, then it's right in line with a lot of ancient mysticism and A Course in Miracles, which says, you know, there is no world. There's only the projection of the mind. But we've made that such a big deal, and we're so enmeshed in our humanness that we vastly underestimate how entrenched we've been and become in that we kind of, you know, sort of like at talking to a fish about water, and they say, what's that?
Well, exactly.
We're swimming in it.
Well, and yeah. You know what? I know this is one of the most difficult things to articulate, but would you, in a few sentences or longer, talk about when we say level confusion, what is the Course talking about?
Okay. There's really, and I think this article that Ken Wapnick writes is of course brilliant. It really identifies two levels of level confusion. So I'm going to do it in reverse order because I think that's probably more helpful to most of your listeners and certainly to most everybody, really, because I'll address the first one briefly, and the first one that he talks about is level one and level two. And level one, the pure non-dual metaphysics of A Course in Miracles, really is talking about the perfect oneness, the unchangeable love and peace and joy and what we would think of as, you know, unfathomable, unstoppable, unchangeable, ecstatic oneness with all that is. You know, we could throw all kinds of words at it, but that's not where we live. That's the truth of what we are. But we have work to do before we get to that. And so that's the level one that the Course talks about. And we get little snippets of it. We get tastes of it throughout. I'm like the Forgotten Song, for example, I think touches on that beautifully. There's a lot of places in the Course that hint that that's our real nature, and kind of like a little pep talks, like this is what we truly are. You know, keep going, keep forgiving yourself. But the bulk of the Course really is looking at the ego, which is the other half of what's called level two. And so level two is really the dualistic world of the contrast between, as Ken puts it, the wrong-minded nightmare dreams of the ego's thought system of separation, sin, guilt, and fear. And I'm just reading that from the first paragraph in the article. With the right-minded happy dreams of the Holy Spirit's correction, which consists of the miracle, forgiveness, and healing. I've got that highlighted because I think that's such a pivotal, you know, concept. So really confusion is basically when we attribute one aspect or one characteristic of a level to another. So whenever, for example, if, you know, you hear someone saying, well, I am changing my special relationship to a holy relationship. Well, in truth, the only holy relationship, the only truly integrated oneness that we have is with the self that we never left that includes everyone. And that's, again, an example of where I think specialness is a perfect example of this, the second split, if you will. So the level of confusion that we really are admonished and encouraged to deal with throughout the bulk of A Course in Miracles is the split between the right mind of what we really are, which is represented by symbolically this inner voice of kindness, this inner teacher of kindness that basically suggests that if we bring all the things that seem to be outside of us back inside, we're collapsing the space. And if we realize that in truth nothing happened, if we can make that quantum leap in mind to that sort of cosmic perspective where we see the fleeting lives that we have as that, and that, and the vastness of what we even the dream that we think of as time, that they're really, I think a good way to look at this is, if you look at something that's annoying you or irritating you or you're grieving over or having, it's whatever level of struggle, the magnitude doesn't matter, but any kind of an issue, that's less than perfect happiness.
Yeah.
which covers quite a bit.
About 99.9% of the time. Okay.
Yeah, truly. If we're honest with ourselves, and that's again another challenge, but that the ego doesn't want us to look at that and just tries to gloss it over. But if we look at that, most of our time is spent in this dream of victimhood and thinking that there's something or someone or some set of situations, and it can be a whole bunch of things, all cumulative, that happen to us that are making our lives miserable or less than perfect or whatever. And if we can kind of collapse the time and realize that in the cosmic scheme of things, if we can't even remember what we had for breakfast yesterday, typically, let alone, let's say a year ago, that's probably a little easier. let alone, a childhood hurt that, we keep dragging back into the present, this dead horse that we keep, resurrecting and trying to exhume and breathe life into, that all of these grievances and issues that all relate to the past in some way, the past that we believe happened. If we can collapse that, then we've collapsed the space of otherness back to the self. We've collapsed the time of the dream back to now, where we have the ability to choose that inner kindness teacher now at any given moment. Then we can, then from that perspective, which is what the Course calls above the battleground, we can look down at that awareness. That decision-making capacity between the right and wrong-minded choices of blame versus forgiveness, and realize, okay, A, nothing happened. B, because nothing happened, and there's no one out there for anything to happen from, I can afford to forgive because there's no basis for it in truth. And I think that is why the ego's one of the chief weapons of the ego to keep us mindless is this level of confusion of thinking that there's something out there, there's something special, there's something different about me, there's something that's keeps us tuned into what might be a method or a mechanism for looking at ourselves as being unique, but it's always in a way that leads to some kind of victimhood or some kind of thinking in terms of somebody or something is doing something to us. Mm-hmm. We're in enmeshed in the game of specialness and differences, and that's really what Ken calls the ego's unholy trinity of sin, guilt, and fear, because that really perpetuates the separation and maintains the level of projection where we think that things happen independently of our mind. As long as we think that things happen independent of our thoughts and that they come unbidden, that, oh, I didn't ask for this, you know, I didn't ask to be born. then we're always at the effect of, or at the mercy of, what's happening outside ourselves, and that plays in beautifully into the ego's the whole game of thinking that you know, as long as I can keep the cause outside my own mind, then I don't have to look at the unconscious guilt. I don't have to look at what's going on inwardly, because the ego knows that if we really truly look at that, we'll see that there's nothing there. It's all a ruse. It's a hoax. It's a fraud. It's a facade. It's just a game that is being made up to, and pretending that we somehow were able to fracture and fragment and wound or kill perfect oneness. We think that somehow we took this perfect oneness that we can call God or what do we want to call it, and destroyed it, and we're now all prodigals from this horrific act that we think we committed that in truth never happened. And so we went to this great lengths of making up an entire universe of issues.
Right.
And so that we could persuade ourselves that there's something that we still need to do in the world. And again, this is not saying this, and this is part of the level of confusion. It's not saying that we shouldn't do the things that come up for us to do during the day as a normal, you know, everyday human being. Mm-hmm. You know, if at the appropriate time, it's probably good to brush your teeth, go to work, you know, attend to your family's needs, your community, you know, take care of your own health regimen, balance your checkbook, whatever it is, you know, all the everyday stuff that we do that basically maintains the stuff in the world that is everybody else does. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it'd be silly to not do that. And I think that's one of the things in this article where I can, you know, it's either this article or similar ones where he says, you know, that's particularly inappropriate form of denial if we deny what's going on in our human world.
Right. But in fact, that is one of the things he says, is that that's one of the most classic signs, or one of the things that we do for level confusion.
Exactly.
Is we say, well, I can do anything with my body because it doesn't really matter. You know, I'm not a body. I am a spirit, and or however you want to say it, you know, I am a mind, and therefore I can do anything with my body that I want because it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
And that's you know, it almost reminds me, and I don't know, maybe I'm opening up a can of worms, but I heard something recently that made me think of this very thing. And it was, somebody had reminded me, there was a shooting, and now this has been many years ago, but there was a shooting in which a number of children were involved. Mm-hmm. And it was a shooting that involved a particular religious group. Uh-huh. And the person said, and you know, the evening of the shooting, some of the elders or some of the people from the church actually went to the home of the wife, or, and I think in this case it was a widow of the man who had done the shooting, to basically offer forgiveness. And on one hand, I thought, wow, that's really impressive. That's really cool. But one of my first thoughts was, you know, I'm not saying that that's not possible, but uh-huh. You've just now had 10 or 12 or how many ever young school children that were killed. And now if you're part of that religious sect, you've got this outward appearance of, we have to offer forgiveness. And in a sense, we have to act like nothing happened. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not within that sect, so I can't say what happened. But what happened in my heart as I heard that story is, yes, outwardly, that sounds really good. But what happens to those people who aren't at that place yet?
Exactly.
Do they have the opportunity to really get into their grief and to really process that, mm-hmm. to really come to a place of forgiveness? Because it's not really good enough to just say, well, my belief is that I have to offer you forgiveness, so you're forgiven.
Right.
You know,
right.
We know that. That is what we do for forgiveness in the world for the most part. And we don't get to that place of going, you know what? I really wasn't attacked. Nothing really happened to me. I'm not the victim of the world I see. But it just kind of occurred to me, because I thought within that group, there probably were people who had so worked their lives that they did feel forgiveness 6 hours later. But my guess is I find it hard to believe that as a group, they really felt forgiveness 6 hours later. Right. Now, maybe I'm being cynical, but that was one of those situations where I thought, whoa, you know, if you were a teenager or if you were a child, could you really process that whole idea of, okay, we just need to forgive and forget? You know, now your friends have been brutally and innocently shot, you know? Right. So it was just something that came up, and it really made me think of the level of confusion and whether or not, I mean, and what would be the appropriate thing? Because I think to offer forgiveness was the appropriate thing, probably, but was it real forgiveness?
When it's burning low, only miss the sun when it starts to snow, only know you love her when you let her go, only know you've been high when you're feeling low, only hate the road when you're missing home, only know you love her when you let her go.
Welcome back, everybody, or maybe I should say welcome back to myself, because it sounds like we kind of dropped off there, and I'm not quite sure exactly where we dropped off, but this is CA, and this is ACIM, or A Course in Miracles, on Friday mornings here on 1-2 Radio, and my guest is Bruce Rawls, and Bruce, I just ask you a question, is that real forgiveness, and that's when the line kind of dropped, and so do you want to answer that question?
Oh, sure, thanks. Yeah, I think we were starting down the avenue of the content versus form issue. And the example that comes to mind is that several years ago, I went to a funeral, and I had just been listening to some of Ken's conversations about, you know, the form that the compassion and the kindness and the forgiveness takes doesn't have to be anything specific that is something that we decide on our own. And I think that's where listening to our inner kindness teacher, we will know exactly in moment to moment when we're doing something that's kind and appropriate and helpful. And sometimes it might just be going to, you know, like in my case, a family member, and just giving them a big hug and not really saying much, but just letting them know that, you know, I feel for their loss. And at the same time, providing a comfort that, you know, doesn't have to involve you know, platitudes or any kind of you know, shoulds or oughts or any of that kind of thing, and that may be, you know, applicable to the example you gave about the shooting. I think a lot of times what people just need to do is grieve, and if we assume something, again, we're kind of getting back to what we talked about earlier, is we have no idea what's going on in people's minds necessarily, but we can certainly draw from that feeling of connectedness that will lead us to do the right thing or the appropriate thing that is the most helpful. And if we just have to kind of get our own self out of the way, and I think that's one of the ways that we can undo the level of confusion by listening and practicing listening to that voice and you know, just doing with the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever's appropriate for that situation, because it's not the form, it's not the gesture or the behavior. And of course, miracles, you know, is again, it's not about behavior. And I think Ken brings that out in this article we've been discussing very, very powerfully. Is if we think that there's some special place or some special way of behaving or some special food or diet or clothing or, you know, some regimen, some, you know, anything involving space or time or form, is suspect, because it's not about that. But we can use those forms to have them be the medium or the instrument through which that kindness is expressed. And I think, again, that you can't really just have a hard and fast cookie cutter rule to say, oh, if A, then do B, because that's, again, it's not about the behavior. So what that really suggests is that we need to continue to persistently watch our minds, find out what the motivations are, why are we doing what we're doing, and if we can look at that, then we can, when we start to go down the road of, oh, I'm doing this because I think you need help. Danger, Will Robinson. Yeah, alert, alert. That's like when the serious inner alarms should be going off in your mind. And if we peel back the masking tape over our dashboard that we try to ignore those indicators, we'll start to notice that there's a lot of times when if you defend yourself or if you're trying to promote or in some way do something that maintains the separation, that basically is we're confusing levels again. We're thinking that there's something outside of us that needs to be done when really the only thing that really needs to be done is I need to drop my judgment. I need to drop my belief that I understand from the perspective of this little separate individual, this person that I call Bruce a fiction sometimes. Mm-hmm. And if I can do that, if I can kind of remind myself that hasn't gotten me anywhere. Or to use Tomas Vieira, who's another course teacher that's no longer with us, but he had this wonderful, metaphor of the used car salesman, and with a pork pie hat and a plaid shirt and a stogie hanging out of his mouth, and every time we approach this guy, he says, "Oh, I know I've steered you wrong before, but trust me this one last time, because this beautiful lemon, or I mean car here, is going to be the one that's going to do it for you." And I think if we can just kind of adopt an amused and gentle inner laugh of whenever we start to get ego's counsel that says, "Okay, you've got your own interests here, and you better stick up for those." I mean, not that we don't do things for ourselves, but if we do things in isolation, if it's at the expense of, that's the red flag that we're, again, confusing levels. We're making the form more important than the content. And if the content is kindness, if the content is shared interest and following that inner guidance, then we won't have any trouble. But the ego, again, will maintain that's not going to get us what we want, because we've so convinced ourselves that we're this ego character and that its interests trump everyone else's. And that's the old what's in it for me paradigm, that the we-they paradigm that basically says that my interests are more important than yours or someone else's. And that's what war is. I mean, the magnitude might be different. It may be just a domestic squabble on a small level, or a difference of opinion of when we see something on the evening news or listen to something on the radio or the web or whatever. But inwardly, if we can realize that it's all the same illusion, it's all the same dream, and anything that I do to make myself different or better or worse or anything that creates the identity of apartness is really taking me further away from the peace that is my inevitable, eternal birthright and heritage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and one thing I loved in this article is he quotes it from the course, mm-hmm. but he literally says the miracle rearranges perception.
Yes.
And see, I love lines like that because the miracle rearranges our perception. And I think I like it for a couple of reasons. One is certainly because I don't have to, with my mind, maybe figure this all out. But right. if I open myself up to it, if I'm willing to say there must be another way to look at this, if I keep, maybe peace as my goal or understanding or change, then the miracle can rearrange my perception.
Yep, exactly. Because we get out of the driver's seat at that moment and as ego, and let our inner kindness teacher, which is what we really are, but we need to work up to that typically. and then that basically allows us to see things differently. I mean, that was Helen and Bill's, Helen Struckman and Bill Thetford's original impetus for this whole, what became this wonderful series of books is there must be a better way. There must be something that can rearrange the perception and change the thought system. And that's really the only thing that we can change. Because I think part of the level of confusion is we think that there are differences in the world, and if we can somehow bolster up the things we like and diminish the things we don't like, and you know, just rearrange, it's like being a holodeck repairman.
Yes.
And you know, to use the Star Trek metaphor, is we keep thinking that, well, if I keep at it, maybe I can make this holodeck of a dream world that we call reality serve my purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we're thinking along those lines, ego is solidly in the driver's seat. And it's a sneaky character, because we're incredibly bright. We're bright enough to have made an entire universe to hide out in. So we need to use that same brilliance, but with a different teacher. The one that's 100% sane instead of the one that's 100% insane 24/7 to undo the seeming mess that we made by realizing that it has no effect on us. And like you say, that's a shift in perception. When we shift our perception to realize, that, you know, as one of the paragraphs in this article says, the correction of fear is your responsibility, that no one out there is going to do it for us. Not even, you know, our inner kindness teacher. We have to make that choice. And that's where we pivot on that, fulcrum that is really the dividing, line between the right mind and the wrong mind, as the Course refers to it, or the Holy Spirit and the ego thought system. And once we recognize that we have to make that choice ourselves between any illusion and reality, then that becomes the opportunity to see that we can do that 24/7. We can do that whenever we want. But typically it's a gradual process. It's a gradual undoing where we look at our mind, say, oh, this isn't working so well for me, you know. And I like to imagine our inner kindness teacher as sort of with a gentle smile, looking down on our dream world like the Cheshire Cat looking down on the chessboard of Alice in Wonderland and the battles going on there and saying, how's that working out for you?
Yeah. Exactly.
when we're enmeshed in the dream and enmeshed in our own stuff and thinking that it's so important and there's such big deals going on in our life, and not that we shouldn't do the appropriate thing. Again, it's not about behavior. You know, do the things you think you need to do, but begin as you're doing them, multitasking, as you're doing them, cultivate the idea that, oh, I can be mindful while I'm doing all the things throughout my day, and that mindfulness can encompass and embrace this thought system that says, yeah, this is my forgiveness classroom. This is my opportunity to see how ego wants me confused, to make the level of form important instead of the level of content in the mind, the real big deal. And the beauty of it is it's incredibly simple, because all we have to do is choose that teacher. And then once that teacher's in the driver's seat and we've moved over to passenger mode as egos, and it's like, oh, well, now I'm seeing this totally differently. The perception, the shift in perception has occurred, and we realize, oh, this is not a prison. This is a classroom. I'm no longer the victim of the world I see. I'm actually, on some level, always contributing to that interpretation, if I, you know, buy into this dream figure's nonsense, but I don't have to. I don't have to buy into that. I can choose a different interpretation.
Mm-hmm. And I love what you said before about the ego being a magician.
Because
certainly in this article of Ken's about level confusion, you know, he brings that out, that as long as we can stay focused on all these little details, all these little conflicts, then we can keep pretending that they are the cause. And, you know, one of the analogies I always love to go back to, because this is, you know, I've seen people kind of do this sort of thing, but it's just an analogy. And that is, like, for instance, if you're baking a cake or you're baking cookies and you forget an ingredient, which sometimes happens, like, sure. And let's say you leave out the salt. Well, you know, that can affect a number of different things, but certainly the flavor, because there's no balance. But, you know, let's say you bake the cookies and the cookies don't come out like you want, well, you can't, you know, shake the salt on top of the cookies. You've got to go back to the batter. I mean, right. And you know, and yet we do that all the time, don't we? We try to fix something. We try to fix something after the fact.
Right,
and the truth is, many times you cannot. And as long as we keep focusing on the cookies versus on the batter, then we won't fix the problem.
That's a good metaphor. I like that. Yeah.
Well, I like it because, I mean, I see myself doing that in my life. And sometimes I go, stop, just stop this. Right. Yeah. You know, whether or not it's a spiritual issue or whether it's physical, it's like you can't change the effect. You can only change the cause.
Exactly.
Now, I want to ask you a question. Somebody in the chat room, and this may take us down a different road, but I want to be responsive to people asking questions.
Sure.
Judy says, what does, and in quotes, not to be confused with the Jesus of, end quote, mean? That got her attention. Now, because she didn't finish the sentence, I wasn't sure. But I'm thinking that she's asking us the many, many times it either can or in the course where, you know, Ken will say the Jesus of the course is not to be confused with the Jesus of the Bible or the Jesus as part of the illusion. But do you want to address that question?
I think you just did.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, maybe to elaborate a little, because I think you answered very nicely. For people that are not familiar with the Course in Miracles who might be listening, The idea is that Helen Schuckman, who was the scribe of this series of books, was basically channeling, if you will, or receiving information from a being that referred to himself or itself as Jesus. And Ken, I think, points out very beautifully that in a lot of his work that the Jesus of A Course in Miracles really has a totally different message than the schizophrenic Jesus of conventional religion that basically suggests that, you know, one day God is going to be, you know, kind and the next day vengeful, and then there's this dichotomy between, you know, in conventional religion, between this one special, specific person that walked the earth a couple thousand years ago, that is, you know, the Son of God of that particular religion, and no religions, you know, really that are conventional and formal religions really, I think, escape this very much. But there's always a we they, you know, there's those that are saved and those that are condemned to hell, and the Course's Jesus suggests something totally different, that unless we include everyone, not on the level of form. I mean, for example, I've got a potluck here tomorrow evening. I'm hoping that we'll get a good turnout, but I don't really want all 7 billion people on the planet to show up at my door tomorrow
okay.
evening. So on the level of form here,
what,
you know,
was that address, Bruce?
Maybe I better not give it. But on the level of form, you know, it would be silly to try to include everyone. But in our heart, if we can recognize everyone is fighting the same battle, everyone, all 7 billion of the humans that I, you know, am aware of, give or take, on this planet, are fighting the same battle. We're all fighting that same ego demon, you know, that is essentially trying to convince us that there's differences. And I think that's the brilliance of A Course in Miracles thinking, is that we really truly need to let go that there are differences. I mean, the very first miracle principle is, you know, there's no order of difficulty and no order of differences among miracles. They're all the same. And because if everything in space-time is really a projection of the same mind, then if we back up enough above the battleground, you know, I'm probably mixing a bunch of metaphors here, but if we can look at our mind with sufficient clarity, which is what our inner kindness teacher, symbolized by the J or Jesus of the Course, or our inner kindness teacher represents, then we can see that all the dreams that we have are the same. And we can learn over time to generalize and to realize that every single issue that seems to be a different big deal is really the same little deal.
Right.
But we've made it into a big deal to the extent that we get upset by it. And I think over time, it doesn't mean that, you know, like, for example, if you see your kid running out in front of traffic, you know, you don't run out and yank the kid back and you know, scold him. But the words that you share with this kid, rather than "you horrible person," could be "I love you, damn it. Don't do that." You know, "I don't want you ground under," you know, kind of thing, because you're important to me. You know, it can be that message rather than one of differences. It basically can be a message where the content is, "I'm the same as you, and therefore I want you to be happy." And you know, this behavior was counterproductive to that happiness that we both really want to share, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, just to finish off before we run out of time to Judy's question, one thing I would say is, like I said, because of the way the question is formed, I may or may not be understanding it correctly. But I would say I don't think you can confuse, or it's better not to confuse, the Jesus of the Course with the Jesus of the Bible. Because right. If you try to put those two things together, it's just not going to jive. But yeah. If you're a person, if you've come from a very Christian background, you know, Ken Wapnick has actually written one or two books that crosswalk between Christianity and the Course in Miracles. Uh-huh. But one thing Bruce was kind of alluding to, which once again can kind of just suck the oxygen right out of your lungs, is that Jesus, you know, in fact, Bruce referred to himself as fictional Bruce. Well, in our dream, we have to recognize that everybody's fiction. So the Bible and even the Course in Miracles and the Jesus of the Bible, they're fiction. That's part of the dream. Right. Jesus and Buddha and all of those characters are representations of something that we have created in our dream, maybe to aspire to. You know, maybe those are our heroes, but they're still part of the dream. And so I think wherever you got that particular statement, I think part of it was just saying, don't try to reconcile pieces of the dream with what we're trying to get you to see here. Because once again, it's the ego, the magician, who is trying to create a distraction so that you'll look at something else.
Yes.
You know,
exactly.
And you may even be looking at, well, Jesus didn't say that. Jesus didn't say that. How could this be the same person? So if we get all wrapped up in trying to figure out what the disparities are, the differences, as uh-huh. Bruce was saying, then, you know, then we're caught right back into the magician's illusion.
Right, right. And it actually kind of ties into the conversation we had before we got on the show about, you know, if we look at the body of the material that's in, using the word body in a different way, the material that's in A Course in Miracles in its full context, then we see that it really is about undoing our belief that bodies are what we really are. And if we can remember that entire context, that the whole thrust and the whole emphasis on this teaching is that we are one being, and that separation and that illusion is really just a dream we made up. That you know, as the beginning of the book says, you know, nothing real can be threatened, nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of God, and that's basically, in a nutshell, the whole thought system that really is very different from the ideas in conventional religion. And again, if the conventional religions are helpful, you know, use whatever mixture is appropriate, but it's important to not confuse a non-dual thought system with one that's intrinsically dualistic.
And it's so difficult to do unless every single moment you try to be conscious of, who is my teacher? Right. Am I listening to the inner right. kindness teacher, or am I listening to the ego? And that's a difficult thing. I mean, it's very difficult. It takes a lot of energy to stay conscious.
Well, it does. It does. And I would actually suggest that it takes a lot of energy to be unconscious, too.
Oh, good point. Very good point.
In fact, a dear friend of mine who's not really a course teacher per se, but he's done wonderful workshops on forgiveness. His name's Leonard Lasko. I used to do his website and was a good friend and a buddy of his in Southern Oregon. He and his wife, Sama, just moved to Switzerland. One of Len's comments that really struck me once was, you know, it takes an enormous amount of energy to maintain the belief in separation. And I'm paraphrasing that greatly, but that's like kind of struck me between the eyes once. Like, well, yeah, it does. Because it's an incredibly busy firefighting mind that the ego keeps going to keep the levels confused, to keep us distracted, to keep us focused on the magician on the stage instead of on the observers in the audience, which, you know, we can sit there with our inner Jesus munching popcorn and saying, oh, well, that's amusing. We notice the escapades and shenanigans of our lives, you know, going in a direction that we hadn't expected or that we find upsetting. And if we get back in the audience, we can say, ah, that's right. I have a choice as to how I feel about this. And then I'm reminded of a big banner that I put above my bedroom wall years ago when I was a teenager. I first started studying metaphysics and mind stuff, and I put, I'm choosing to feel this way, in big block letters on the wall.
Well, and you know, I'm so glad that you actually came up with that, or that you corrected me in essence, because you're right. Even in the course, you know what it says? It says, you weary yourself.
Yes.
You know, you just, and when you think about that, that's it. You're carrying all these burdens, you know, you're trying to do all this stuff, and all you have to do is let it go. Yeah. You know, turn the movie off.
Right.
And just relax.
Right. Well, in a sense, we're using the same amount of energy 24/7 either way. We're just either directing, you know, a certain percent of it to the ego, or a certain percent to hold what the Course calls a Holy Spirit, or inner kindness teacher, or Jay or Jesus. You know, Jay's the Gary and Renard teacher's acronym for, you know, one letter abbreviation. But it, as long as we tune into that awareness that relates to shared interests and being kind and following that guidance that is inclusive, then we can begin to start to undo that confusion and begin to undo the belief in separation that says that what's out there is the cause, which is nutso. And
right.
Yeah.
Well, and Bruce, I'm looking at my clock and already we are out of time. So I just want to say thank you so much for being here. I hope I hope you'll come back again either at the end of October or maybe in November, and we'll come up with a topic and we'll just have a great time talking. And everybody that listened today, I want to tell you thank you. And thank you for the people in the chat room. And I think as we continue the show in the weeks ahead, we will be answering more questions. So if you have questions, go ahead and post them in the chat room during the show, or you can actually contact me at ca@cabrooks.com, and you know, we'll address those questions on the show. And also, I, for those of you listening, I did post a link to Ken's article on level confusion right there in the chat room. So even if you're not there right now, you can later go to Facebook and go to where you see the show having been played today, and you can see that link. So go ahead and check that out if you want to. It really is an excellent article and so clear on level confusion. So I think you're going to be interested in that. And I also want to thank Scott Weaver for being here today and for producing the show and getting us back on the air when we dropped off so abruptly. Thank you very much, Scott, for doing that.
Yes.
And everybody, I hope you will stay tuned to 1-2 Radio today, because we have a whole lineup of shows this morning or early afternoon, depending on where you are. And right now, you've got about 5 minutes before we start our show, The Through Line with Christine DeMaurier, which is coming up next on Fabulous Fridays. So stay tuned. And until next week, relax and wear loose clothes and take your attention away from that magician's illusions and start looking at the magician and seeing what he's doing. Find another teacher. You've been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.